I don't know how many of you have seen the movie The Matrix, but there's a wonderful scene in the movie where Neo, the protagonist, sort of understands the context of his existence. And when that happens, the scene fades away and you see these strings of bits running up and down the screen. And then he sort of understands he's in the Matrix and what his power is, what have you. And so one thing that one can wax philosophical, how would you know if you existed in the Matrix? I mean, that's a real business. How could you answer such a question about whether you lived in a Matrix? Well, the way that physicists work, we would like to probably go probing the structure of the universe looking for some kind of signature. And so in some sense today, what I'm going to tell you is a very strange story whose punchline is, well, we'll wait to the end. So let me begin by talking a little bit about supersymmetry in the most primitive ways possible. I know that you folks have a lot of expertise here across a broad range of areas. So for some of you, this first part will be boring. For those of you who don't know about supersymmetry, maybe this will be a nice soft introduction. So the basic idea is that the universe that we live in can be split into two parts. It consists of a set of objects that we can call bosonic fields, things like the photon, the graviton, the usual things that we study in physics, and fermions, so the most familiar being the electron. The idea of supersymmetry is that two sets of objects that we saw previously, there's a mapping on them so that you can map the bosonic set into a set of objects that are constructed from the original fermion set. And you can match the original fermion set into a set of objects that you construct from the bosonic set. And so this thing is actually called the supercharge. It's just a mapping operator that switches those two sets. It has certain properties, which I've enumerated here, but I won't bother being more explicit than that. The other thing that we know about our universe is it seems to possess these things we call translations, that we can perform motion. And translations acting on these sets, well, the infinitesimal generator translation is actually just a partial derivative. So if we're a boson and we want to be translated, then you should apply to me a partial derivative. If I'm a fermion and you want to translate me, then you should apply a partial derivative. But we don't do any mixing across the two sets. And so the definition of supersymmetry is that first map, which does the mixing, satisfies a composition rule. And the composition rule is here, that if you apply two of these switching operations to the sets, and then do it in a different order of using parameters epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, that generates precisely a translation, where the translation parameter is composed of the two fermionic switching operations. That's the simplest definition of supersymmetry that I can give you. Now, it turns out that supersymmetry has been around almost a little bit longer now than 30 years. But even 30 years now into this idea of supersymmetry, there are questions that we don't know how to answer. And one of those questions, curiously enough, is what is the general solution to this equation? Now, we know some specific solutions where this is satisfied. So how come so much progress has been made in this last 30 years? Well, it turns out that there's another modification of this equation, which we're very efficient at exploiting. And this modification says, well, when you look at this composition rule, you want translations plus things that are derivable as Euler-Lagrange equations from some action. In other words, this is what we call on-shell supersymmetry. So we know how to solve this very efficiently. This we don't know how to solve efficiently in its generality. Now, this problem has been around, as I said, almost from the birth of supersymmetry. Most of us have been satisfied using this because, after all, that's where we've learned about BPS states and strings. And I mean, Bob Myers, I think, is here somewhere. Rob, are you here? Yeah, there you go. And so he's explicitly exploited this with giant gravitons. All of this stuff has sort of come out of understanding the on-shell supersymmetry representations. But the off-shell supersymmetry representations are not known in general. Now, let me just say one of the things that drives me in this discussion is if you look at what we do in field theory, ordinary field theory, we like to keep symmetries manifest. That's why we prefer to quantize, say, QED using a Lorentz gauge as opposed to a Coulomb gauge. It can be done in a Coulomb gauge. And in fact, I don't know how many of in graduate school were still taught, but when I was in graduate school, we actually learned how to first quantize QED and the Coulomb gauge, and you learn through how these calculations, and then at the end of the day, you find out the Green functions of Lorentz invariance, so you don't worry about what happened in between. But you can also quantize in the covariant gauge, and covariant quantization is means ultimately for Yang-Mills theory introducing ghosts. But at each stage, you can see the Lorentz invariance. It manifests as you work through the perturbative calculations. Now, the other thing about quantization is that we like, well, a lot of us like path integrals, or at least we eventually learned to like path integrals. Maybe we were taught with canonical quantization. But path integrals are sort of an intuitive way to understand what's going on in quantum theory. Of course, this was brought to us by Feynman himself, because Feynman's view of the path integral is that if you understand how a system works quantum mechanically, you introduce a set of variables just as you would in a classical regime. Now, in the classical regime, these variables obey a set of equations of motion. If they're point particles, well, then it's Newton's second law. If they are photons, then it's Maxwell's equations. If they're electrons, it's Dirac's equation. But they, in the classical regime, they have these equations that we calculate, use to calculate physical properties with. But Feynman's view was, if you're going to do quantum mechanics, you should let those variables sometimes take configurations that are not solutions to the classical equation of motion. This is sort of what we mean by an off-shell configuration of a field. And Feynman's idea is, if you want to know quantum mechanics, you have to be able to efficiently and effectively enumerate the off-shell configurations as well as the on-shell configurations of a system. And it turns out, so that's what I'd like to think of as the great principle for quantum mechanics, that I really ought to understand quantum mechanics off-shell. And if there are symmetries, I want to keep them present. So I want to keep these two principles present. And if you believe in these two things very deeply, then you ought to be troubled about our situation in supersymmetry. Because you see, in supersymmetry, since we're using this all the time, we're on-shell. That means that if you want a manifest supersymmetric formulation, where you keep supersymmetry manifest at all stages, and you want to, say, do it with a path integral, you don't have the machinery to do that in general for supersymmetrical theories. And certainly not in the most interesting ones, for example, string field theory, where there the pure spinner formalism is the best we can do in coming close to something that looks like a covariant quantization. And even it has problems. If you talk to experts in pure strings, they'll tell you about some of the things that are going on there. So this is the kind of problem that's bothered a lot of us of my generation. I'm so old, you know, we're almost back to the beginning of the subject. And so we know this problem's there, but mostly we don't work on it. So last decade or so, I've started thinking about this problem with some depth and some vigor. That's what I'm going to tell you about today. So I've talked to you about the off-shell problem. Here's a demonstration of the simplest supersymmetrical system that we know of. I'm sorry, I don't know what's going on here. There we go. So this is a so-called chiromultiple. Here's the chiromultiple with this thing called the auxiliary field. It turns out that those mappings between fermions and bosons work exactly as I described for this system up here. If we look at the Euler-Lagrange equations, so we can derive them, we notice this thing F has an algebraic equation. That says you can solve this algebraic equation. Plug it back into, well, first the equation of motion, and we say, aha, we have a Klein-Gordon object here and a fermion, a mass of both the same mass. Or we could take this and substitute it into the action, and then, of course, there's no sign of this object F, and then this is a sort of conventional-looking field theory. We can calculate properties there. So the off-shell problem really is sort of the reverse. If you start with some system that looks like this, how do you go backwards to find its analog like that? And that's the thing that we don't know how to do now, even now in 30 years. For example, if you take 10-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, we know this Lagrangian. It consists of a 10-dimensional spinner and a 10-dimensional gauge field, and that's all. It is not an off-shell theory. It's an on-shell theory. It satisfies that lower realization of supersymmetry. How do you get to the one that's upper? Nobody knows. And there's a series of these things where this is exactly the answer. So that's the problem I'm wrestling with. How do you get information about that? So I'm going to now jump to something totally different, having explained what my goal is. We're going to now come at this from a very different point of view. We're going to start with something that's obvious to all people of any mathematical sophistication, and that is that cubes exist in all dimensions. A cube is a geometrically simple object that you can think about existence in any a space of arbitrary numbers of directions. In fact, you can even go to the Wikipedia, that's authoritative source on all information. And you'll find this list of hypercubes. So we have the point is listed as a cube, the square, the hexahedron, which is the ordinary cube, the tesseract, which is the cube in four space. And this list goes on forever, because cubes are really very simple things to begin with. So let me start by asking you to consider a cube. Actually, we're going to consider three of them. So here's the line segment, which is kind of a degenerate cube. You take the line segment, lift horizontally, and you can generate a square. You take the square, lift vertically, you can generate a cube. And if we had another direction of space, we could take this thing and lift it into the other orthogonal direction and generate a tesseract. And we keep lifting orthogonal directions. So this sequence goes on forever. Let's go to the square. Let's populate the vertices of the square with some objects. And we're going to take two classes of objects. We're going to call them open nodes and closed nodes. Ultimately, we're going to identify these things as bosonic and fermionic states. So we just put them at the vertices of the square. But we put them with the rule that if you take a given link, you have to have on one side of the link a boson, and on the other side a link of a fermion. So you never link boson to boson and fermion to fermion, for obvious reasons, because we're trying to model the supersymmetric transformations which map between the two sets. We give color to the orthogonal directions. Ultimately, we're going to be interested in supersymmetric representations with large numbers of supersymmetries. The supersymmetries, in fact, are the directions of the cube in this construction. That's what we're going to find. And so we can use color to keep track of that. There's a plus or minus sign we have to keep track of. And graphically, we can do that by simply inserting dashes on the edges. And the rule is, in any two-color closed path, there has to be an odd number of minus signs. We realize that in this particular configuration by putting a minus sign here. Of course, there are other ways we could do it. We could put the minus sign on any of the four legs. That turns out to be irrelevant. Or you could put actually three minus signs in this diagram, and that would obey the rule. And again, that's actually irrelevant whether you put one or three. So that's the other rule. And now finally, let me take this square and give it a height assignment. Say that height matters when I draw this object. And the reason that we're doing this is because in physics, there's this notion of engineering dimension, the dimensionality of a field, for example. And so what we want is, as we draw these bosons and fermion nodes on the diagrams, we want the dimensions of the field operators to be obvious when you look at that. And you can do that by vertically orienting the dots. So we have this figure, which is our turned aside square. But now something rather remarkable turns out to be the case. That image is a kind of a Feynman diagram for a set of supersymmetric differential equations. You know Feynman diagrams. We use them all the time in physics to calculate the quantum corrections to a system. Well, it turns out that with that kind of an image, I can assign Feynman rules. The Feynman rules basically say that for each open node, you associate a bosonic field. For each closed node, you associate a fermionic field. As you go from boson to fermionic node, that's a supersymmetry transformation. If you move with the increasing direction of engineering dimension, you just put the supersymmetry parameter in. If you were to go backwards, you have to insert a factor of IDDT. And if you apply that rule consistently to all the parts of this diagram, you get this set of differential equations. And that set of differential equations, you can verify, satisfies the supersymmetry algebra. And so what we've learned in this one example is that cubes have something to do very deeply with supersymmetry, at least in this example. Now, it could have been an accident. Maybe I pulled the wool over your eyes really fast. So let's see what else we can say. Well, here's another assignment of that same object, where I've taken what was formerly a node in the top and pulled it down and written it so that here I have two bosonic fields with the same engineering dimension. In the previous diagram, when the dot was up top, it had a higher engineering dimension. But here we have two of the same. And now, remember, I told you there's a set of Feynman rules attached to these graphs. So when I apply my Feynman rules to this, I get this set of differential equations, which is different from the original set. We can go back and compare them. But yet, this is also a representation of supersymmetry It has one bosonic dimension, we call that dimension tau, and it's got two super directions, because the number of colors in these diagrams are the number of supersymmetry charges or currents that are apparent. This system is also supersymmetric. One of the interesting things about these images that we've created by this process is that they contain even more information. You'll notice that, well, I'll prove this in a moment, but if you follow my construction for an arbitrary cube, you can always bring it to the form where all the bosons are at one height and all the fermions are at a different height. We call this thing a valise. So this is a valise adinkra. And now, valise adinkras make it obvious about some matrices that are hiding inside the cubes. For example, if we look at this object in green, we see this object, we see this figure. And the interpretation of the numbers are, this is, you can think of these as labeling the rows and the columns of a matrix. And so this is that in the 1-1 entry of a certain matrix, there's the number 1. When you see a solid line, that's the number 1. If you see a dashed line, that's the number minus 1. If you see no line, that's 0. So this says in the 1-1 entry, there's the number 1. It says in the 1-2 entry, there's a 0, because there's no link here. It says in the 2-1 entry, there's 0. And in the 2-2 place, there's a 1. That's this matrix. So by starting with this object and looking in green only, we see this matrix associated with the object. In a similar manner, if we look in red only, we find this matrix associated with the object. Let's try this with a cube. We'll go a little bit faster this time. So we start with an ordinary cube, populate the vertices using our rule that you have to alternate, use different color for distinctive directions, put in the minus sign that every closed two-color path has to have an odd number of minus signs, and you get the figure that I have written here. These objects are like real pieces. You should think of them as real objects that you could construct by taking a bunch of beads and sewing them together with color, you know, taking color thread and gluing them together. So these are like real things, which means, in particular, that if I start with this object, I can actually grab, I can grab this node and yank it up and hold it at the top and watch the figure hang. If I do that, I get this. This isn't quite a valise. However, we can make it into a valise by simply taking this node, pulling it down, taking these three nodes, pulling them down to the lowest level, this object, and now you start acting like you're colorblind, looking into a single color, you find out this object decomposes into three 4x4 matrices. So whatever this prescription is about taking cubes, populating them, putting in minus signs, it always leads to an affiliation with some matrices. You might be interested in knowing something about the properties of these matrices. Let's go just talk about the tesseract for a minute, named the cube in four dimensions. Same general idea. See, it gets fully populated. But the matrices that are associated with these always satisfy an algebra. And the algebra looks like this. These L's are the matrices I explicitly showed you before. R's are simply their transposes. And so it satisfies this identity. And if you look at this long enough, you begin to think, gee, I kind of know what that is. Because, in fact, that's actually Clifford algebras. So cubes, by this funny decoration property, is somehow related to Clifford algebras. What's the explicit relationship? Well, let's go to a real Clifford algebra. For physicists, that means work with gamma matrices. So if I take gamma matrices with n plus 1 vector directions and satisfy Clifford algebra, I can construct a projection operator by taking the very last gamma matrix. And in fact, I can construct two by taking plus and minus. I now take this projection operator and sandwich it around the remaining n of these, and I can form these objects L and R, and they satisfy exactly that algebra we saw coming from our cubes. So cubes, by whatever this decoration procedure that I have given you, connects to Clifford algebras, a direct connection. Clifford algebras, of course, have lots of structure. Let me, in fact, skip this one. I'll perhaps come back. But once you understand that Clifford algebras are connected to these cubes, then, in fact, you begin to be able to say some very interesting things about supersymmetry, and we're going to actually come to this in a moment. This particular table asks the following question. If I start with n colors, how many nodes do I have to have? Because it's not a linear relationship. In fact, what one finds is it's given by this. If you start with n colors, you have to first break it up into integer powers of 8 plus a remainder. So you can always take an arbitrary number, write it as 8n plus n, where n is the remainder, which for me, I'm going to let range between 1 and 8, with the restriction that if n equals 8 times an integer, then m should be k times minus 1 times that integer. If you do that, then what you find is that this is the minimal dimension of matrices and n colors that satisfies that Clifford algebra. This table we're going to use later in the talk to discuss what looks to be a lower bound on all shell representations with the n-dimensional supersymmetry. And here it is. If you do that table, you find out that if you have, my value of n that I'm using is actually the value in one dimension. So n equal 4 in one dimension is actually calligraphic n equal 1 in four dimensions, because for every four-dimensional supersymmetry, there are actually four one-dimensional supersymmetries. And so that table that we just wrote actually determines what we believe to be the minimal off-shell representations of supersymmetry. Now, I can only say believe, well, I can say the following. As long as I stick to quantum mechanics, the belief is actually, it's constructively, we know that this is true, that this does set a minimum lower bound. If you want something like n equal 8 supersymmetry, using this one-dimensional argument, you would think that the smallest multiplet with n equal 8 supersymmetry off-shell, and that's n equal 8 in four dimensions. And this ignores some issues about Lorentz invariance, but minus that caveat, the smallest dimensional representation looks like it contains 32,768 bosons and 32,768 fermions. And that would explain, the caveat is true, that explains something about why we haven't found very many off-shell representations in supersymmetry. Because you see, the way that, if you look at the history of supersymmetry, the way we've basically found off-shell representations, we've been lucky and we've been able to guess. But nobody I know has sat around thinking, gee, you know, I'm going to write some equations where there are 32,768 bosons and 32,768 fermions and say, gee, that's got to be what an off-shell representation looks like. So part of the reason is it's hard. We believe that a message this conveys is that, in fact, the difficulty of solving the off-shell problem. Let me say one other word about the off-shell problem from this point of view. We physicists think we're pretty bright. Well, mathematicians think they're bright, too, but we think we're bright. And I know from time to time I've had friends come and say, you know, you physicists have this problem, you haven't solved it. There's something wrong with you guys. And they always say, you guys, even if they're young women, you guys, right? And so this point of view that supersymmetry is connected, and I still haven't shown, well, is connected to these Clifford algebras, also explains why we physicists haven't solved the problem. A few years ago, I started a collaboration with mathematicians and some computer scientists, basically looking at this set of issues. And one of the first things we discovered in talking to our mathematical colleagues is that the problem we're trying to solve is one that the mathematicians don't know how to solve either. This off-shell problem, namely finding the analogs of the Fs, in the mathematical literature falls in an area called filtered Clifford algebras. Filtered Clifford algebras is a topic that's about 35 to 40 years old, and the representation theory of filtered Clifford algebras is not known by anyone. And so our unsolved off-shell problem in physics is the same as the unsolved representation theory of filtered Clifford algebras in mathematics. So we can hold our heads up high and say, gee, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. You guys didn't do it either.
Nice, but it says conjectures.
Yes.
The number of topologies on that chart.
Ah, well, no, the number of topologies turns out not, that's not the conjectural part. The conjectural part is actually this column here. Because you see, everything to the right of that, we have complete control over, and we know there are no assumptions, and that's all valid. But in that one column, I remember I said the caveat is Lorentz symmetry. Because we don't yet understand how this point of view of basing the construction of supersymmetric models on Clifford algebras, we don't yet know how spin bundles enter. And that's the conjecture part. Until we settle that very firmly, the word conjecture, I think, properly should be there. So let me race ahead. I've shown you a very simple-minded construction. We basically start with matrices. And then at the last slide, I started making arguments that this simple-minded construction that I did in one dimensions has something to do with supersymmetry in four dimensions. So why should I believe that? I mean, is this a way to actually think about space-time supersymmetry? That's a question we should ask. Well, let me start with one of these one-dimensional models. Here it is. It's a particular n equal 4 choice that I've made here. It's a particular set of these R's and L matrices that I have chosen. And this is the result that one gets. You can colorize those transformation laws, and you get this image, which is, in fact, one of these simple-minded cubes. In fact, it's not quite one of the simple-minded cubes. And I know later I'll talk about why it's not quite, but it's related to one of these simple-minded cubes. And that image came directly by trying to find a graphical representation of this set of equations. Let me now, for those of earlier, I talked about the chiral multiplet, which is the simplest off-shell representation of four-dimensional supersymmetry. This is, if you go to many textbooks, you'll find equations that look like this. This describes the chiral multiplet, but I've used only real fields. If you take these set of equations, and here in these equations, all the fields depend on time and the three directions of space. Simply take the equations and by hand say, I will allow none of the fields to depend on spatial coordinates, but only on temporal coordinates. That's something you can do. If you do that, what you find is it reduces to this. Now, when I first told you this, I said I chose choice of those R and L matrices, and that this is the answer that I get by doing that. But now I've just told you that if I start with a fully bona fide, relativistic, four-dimensional supersymmetric system, and I set the spatial coordinates by hand to zero, I am led back to the same linear system of equations. This is rather interesting, because what it says is that if you start with a supersymmetrical system in an arbitrary dimension and simply set the spatial coordinates to zero, you will wind up with a theory where there's a simple temporal dimension, and you will find some set of these R and L matrices. That means that there's a map between supersymmetrical systems and a set of matrices. And when we first understood this, the presence of this map around 2002, we made a conjecture that this is actually a fully holographic map. That in fact, all of the kinematic information we believe of the four-dimensional theory is in fact encoded in these matrices that we see in one dimension that you uncover by this dimensional reduction process. If you do the actual reduction, what you find out is that the four-dimensional fields fold themselves up into a kind of a packet in the lower dimension. And these are the explicit expressions for what those packets look like. Here are R and L matrices. You can work out their algebra. It looks sort of like that. And then you can write an object that is proportional to these matrices. You simply then use the geometric definition of, well, what does the geometric definition mean? Well, we've got these things that are Clifford algebras. We have gamma matrices. We also have essentially also the space of the product of gamma matrices. There's a natural matrix action on that space. And so that part of it, we're not allowed to change how it acts because that's consistent with what we mean by the geometry of the supersymmetry. So there's no there's no wiggle room there. And yet when you do exactly the simple geometrical argument, you find out, you find the reduced versions of the supersymmetry transformations that you got from the field theory. The way that the chiral multiplet looks in one dimension is that it breaks itself up into these matrices times, it also uses fractional derivatives or inverse derivatives. And that's sort of right if you stop and think about it, because the dimensions of F are actually higher than the dimensions of A in the usual supersymmetrical theory. So you actually need something to adjust the dimensions, and that's what these factors of inverse dd tau do for you. Let me skip this. So my claim was every supersymmetrical theory is associated with a set of matrices, and that these matrices actually capture the supersymmetry representation properties of the theory which gave rise to the matrices. Let me try to give you some suggestive evidence about why we think that's true. Yes, please.
The connector to the projector was not tooled.
Yep.
That's worse.
If I do this, it will reset.
Come and fix it.
Who is this? That's
okay. I'll try to keep away from that. So my claim was that these matrices, so every supersymmetrical theory that you can work with in a higher dimension, by this process, has kind of an image down in one dimension, which is a matrix. So if you're going to find the information, so our statement is that the holographic encoding of higher dimensional supersymmetric multiplets consists of two parts. It's the matrices, but it's also these powers of the exponents that you saw in the inverse powers of the time derivative. We think that those two pieces of information are sufficient to reconstruct the theory in higher dimensions. I have to say think because we haven't completed a proof. I'm working with some of my mathematical colleagues, and one of them in particular thinks he has almost finished off a general proof that I can remove the word think and say we know that this is true. But we certainly have, we have examples where we've worked this out, we've seen it work. In fact, the last two papers, if you go to the archive and search for the name FAUX, who's one of my collaborators, the last two papers there are about this lifting process, so you can actually see how to go from the matrices to go back up. Well, you know, the ADZ CFT correspondence has taught us that strings of matrices are often interesting things to look at. So we're going to apply that kind of philosophy to the matrices that we found by this process and ask ourselves, can we understand the properties of these representations by studying strings of tracers? These things, if you're someone who, you know, teaches group theory like I do, when you see strings of tracers, you always think, aha, characters are somewhere afoot. So these are something like characters, and for that reason, decided to call these strings of tracers chromo characters. So you can do this so we have some conjectures based on calculations. We think that if you look at if you take these chromo characters, there are certain rules which say that you can only use even powers of matrices, and that has to do with the fact that since these matrices represent transformations between boson and fermion, it actually doesn't make sense to say, I'm going to trace a fermion index against a bosonic index. So I can trace a bosonic index against a bosonic index, a fermionic index against a fermionic. That means even powers of these matrices have to be used in calculating these trace-like on these character-like objects. So here are some of the characters. So we have a conjecture that for all 4D multiples based on a set of calculations, that it turns out that the first chromo character actually simply counts the number of degrees of freedom in the theory. We also looked at the second chromo character, and there what we find is something rather interesting. Namely, we get one term which counts degrees of freedom, plus this other object, which at first was mysterious. Remember I talked about the tesseract? Well, this is what a tesseract looks like when it's been made into an integral. Tesseract starts off as a cube in four dimensions, therefore has 32 nodes, half those nodes are bosons, half fermions, I'm sorry, 8 each. That's a 16.
And then you do the coloring process. So this is a tesseract that has been made into an adinkra. Well, here's something else. It's not a tesseract. In fact, what is it? Well, let's see if we can figure this out. The way we're going to figure it out, if I can find my image. I'm sorry, I just noticed it. The images have been rearranged since I last gave this talk. There we go. So here's our tesseract. Turns out there's a large automorphism group on this thing. The labels that you give these things are relatively unimportant. So you can do rotations, which in terms of graphics means you simply are training the position of these things. You can also make sign changes on some nodes. And that will and now this is an integral. Because when you integrate a field, you change the dimension of the field. That lowers the nodes. And so the object that you just saw a moment ago looks like this. And now I'm going to bring it to this form, which makes something obvious. Namely, there are two identical subcells in that original picture. Well, if they're identical, maybe we can get rid of one. I've just changed a bunch of signs there. And now, if you'll look carefully, what you'll see is that the subcell on the right is a perfect copy of the subcell on the left, which means that I can bring the two together and act like there's only one subcell, which I can take the least form if I want to extract the matrices, and write like this, which we recognize that's a chiral multiply. So what did we just learn by that sequence of operations? Well, the initial adinkra that we looked at, I'm going to use more conventional language. Okay. The initial adinkra that I showed you, which I will now go back to, which looked like that, is something that people like me and Lee and a bunch of us have been writing for years. We use a symbol V for that object. It starts off with a scalar. Got 4 spinners at the next level. The object that I showed you is the dimensional reduction of this thing. If you've studied some supersymmetry, you recognize this thing. This is called a vector superfield. For those of you who do phenomenology, this part of the vector superfield is very well known to you. In fact, that's what we call the vector multiplet. Here's the photon. Photino, and its associated auxiliary field. And so, in fact, this is a graphical way of talking about the dimensional reduction of this object. And if our conjecture is true about the holographic nature of these matrices, it means that all the kinematic information here is, in fact, encoded in that image. You'll notice that the vector multiplet. It's only part of this thing. So there are some pieces that I didn't draw the circle around. So let's look at those pieces. That's those things there. Again, if you're someone who has a lot of familiarity with supersymmetry, that collection of objects has a name. It's a scalar multiplet. And so, in fact, the initial object that we show over there, which we get directly from a tesseract and turning it into an adinkra, is a representation of supersymmetry. But in fact, it's not a single representation of supersymmetry. It's actually two of them. And the two representations that it contains are these two representations that we talk about in more flowery and more useful language. It's the scalar and vector subcomponents of a general vector superfield. You remember when a moment ago I talked about the chromo characters.
Since my slide's out of order, I have to ask you to forgive me while I move back and forth. I wish I discovered this a moment ago. So let me first of all go back to the vector multiple.
That's what the vector multiple looks like as an adinkra. Here we see the decomposition of the tesseract. First, we've written this in terms of a valise. And then we've done that folding process that you just saw a moment ago to pull out of it two different objects. And the two objects that we have pulled out of it is this object, which turns out to be the chiral multiplet that you see over here, as well as this object, which is the vector multiplet that you see over here. And the numbers that you see listed here are those two values of the objects I showed you in the chromo characters, the D and the chi. On the first representation, it turns out that D is equal to 8, chi is equal to 0. If you use the matrices in this representation to calculate the chromo characters, you find it's 4 and 1. And in this one, you find out that it's 4 and minus 1. And that's exactly mirroring the fact that a vector superfield is possible to take it and pull it apart into two pieces. And here's some evidence that the one dimensions knows how to keep track of each piece. It does so by assigning a different value to the chromo character. It also is a nice linear operation. You'll notice that a vector superfield really is a linear combination of these two. Therefore, if you know some group theory, you would expect that the character of the object on this side to be the sum of the characters on the object on that side. As you can see by simply adding the numbers up over there, it works out just fine. Okay, so we learned about this weird, bizarre folding up process. Let me just say one other thing about adinkras. Again, for some of you perhaps are a little bit more mathematically minded. Adinkras, although we have started using these things to talk about supersymmetric representations, they're in fact present in group theory. It's just that we don't use them. Let me show you an adinkra for SU3. It's sitting on the transparency now. The three quarks, the up, down, and strange quarks can be labeled by a notation like this. If you go to George's book on group theory, you'll see this in there somewhere. And now for SU3, there are 8 generators. You can ask yourself the following question. If I start with a given state and I act on it with a generator, where does that state go in the representation space? In other words, let's trace out the orbits. Well, for two of the generators, namely the third generator and the 8th generator, since they're diagonal, the orbits have to be loops because you start at a state and you come back to that state because it's an eigenvalue. That means if you draw its adinkra, you have to see things like that. So those are the 3rd and 8th generators. On the other hand, you have the other generators, let's call it lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 4, lambda 5, lambda 6, and lambda 7, which we can organize into raising and lowering operators by the usual way that we decompose the group. And if you ask what they do to the orbits, in fact, the group of lines that you see here are the orbits. Mathematical literature, this sort of thing is also sometimes called a Cayley diagram. So an adinkra is a Cayley diagram for space-time supersymmetry. So it's not something that has suddenly come out of no place. It's a notion that it exists in group theory, but we've now started to apply it to supersymmetry representations. What about this crazy folding process that I told you about? Because that was bizarre. Well, this is the part of the talk where things get really strange. I know you thought it was strange before now. Yes?
Associative Clifford algebras to what looked like the Lie algebra.
Yes, and that was because I made a jump there. My point was, although these notions of adinkras and these funny pictures were introduced for supersymmetry, in fact, you could have done that for any compact algebra. And so I was just giving the example in SU3 of how this would look. So it wasn't directly connected to the field, right? This is an illustration that the ideas are available for any group.
And figuring out the IRAP structure of the algebra, the same for associative and...
Well, it turns out, thank you for asking the question, because that's probably something I should have said about. If you look at any classical compact group and you draw its adinkra, what you find is that all classical compact groups have adinkras where these loops occur inside of them. And they have to, because that's the maximal torus, right? Any compact algebra decomposes into a maximal torus, raising and lowering operators. The maximal torus are the things that generate the loops. So any classical compact Lie algebra always has an adinkra where these loops are there. In supersymmetry, those loops are never there. And that's one reason why we think that the representation theory of space-time supersymmetry is distinctly different from the representation theory of classical compact Lie algebras. Because
there are supergroups contain bosonic subgroups.
But it's not a matter of both. Supergroups. But we're not talking about supergroups. We're talking about space-time supersymmetry, which is not, we believe, the same as a supergroup.
So you believe there's no relation between what you do for SU3, couldn't you do for supergroups and then relate to the kind of stuff that...
We see no way that you... One way for me to say it is I don't understand, nor my collaborators understand, how, if you believe that this kind of language is an appropriate way for keeping supersymmetry manifest, we don't understand then how this generates into something where there are loops if you look at the orbits of the generators. And the reasons are, it's actually pretty simple to see why that's the case. Remember, first of all, I'm doing one dimension at this point because that's where I have control over everything. So what does a one-dimensional supersymmetrical theory look like? Well, it's a bunch of supercharges and the Hamiltonian, and that's it, right? So you can, well, first of all, these things can't have loops in them. So the only thing that could generate the loops would be the Hamiltonian itself. But the only way for the Hamiltonian to generate loops is that you work on plane wave states. But plane wave states are, you know, they're, for us, we don't, since we're trying to, analyze this for off-shell, plane waves aren't good enough for us. And the reason is because the plane wave state, if you take a sum of plane waves, is in fact not an eigenstate after the thing. So there, that's why we say no loops. The really weird and bizarre punchline to this talk. I told you and I showed you this folding up process. So what controls this folding up process? Because the way that we came across it is that in the old way of days, we would have said, we would have looked at multiplets like this and then figured out how to find an irreducible representation. That's how we knew how to split things. But in this language, in terms of cubes, what is it that controls the folding up? Well, it turns out the answer is something that information theorists know about. There are these things called doubly even error correcting codes. Now, you have experts here, so I'll let them explain to you what a doubly even error correcting code is. But the point for us is that these things, in fact, control the folding. So let me show you, in some sense, how. An adinkra, as I keep saying, is like a real object. It's like a bunch of beads that you've sewn together with colored strings. So I've hung an adinkra here. And in fact, in this one, what I've done is I basically took one node, I held it in my hand, then I let gravity pull it down. So I get this image. And then I want to start talking about the addresses for these things. So let me give this one at the bottom the address 0000, four zeros. Why only four? Well, if I'm going to go to the next adjacent nodes, here I just use the color red, so I use one red link to get here. If I'm going to go from here to here, I use one green link. If I want to go from here to here, I use one blue link. If I want to go from here to here, I use one black link. So the numbers that you see basically tell me what color links I have to use to get from the reference node to the node I'm traveling to. You can see that if I went to the second level, I need one red and one green to get here. But I could also take one green and one red to get there. And so, in fact, it's independent of the path, but it has the same address. In fact, that property is reproduced all throughout this entire image. That no matter, so if you go from the reference node to any other node, there is a unique address that gets you there, although there may be multiple paths by which you get there. So what happened in the folding? Well, in the folding process, what happened, if you
did this addressing and looked back at the image and kept track of everything, what you would have found is that when the image folded, this node here actually joined with that node there. The node up here actually joins with the node down here. The node here actually joins with the node here. And what's the common feature of all these nodes that are joining? But if you take the sums of their addresses, you realize that they all, after joining, have the same address. And what is that address? Well, again, for people who know something about self-dual error correcting codes, that's the simplest self-dual error correcting code. And so what we found in this example is that the folding up, the fact that this thing splits into two representations is the statement that when you get to the tesseract, it's the first time that a self-dual error correcting code exists. See, you could have asked this question when I drew the square. You could have said, why doesn't the square decompose into two separate representations? The answer is that there are no self-dual error correcting codes that small, and that's why the square was a single irreducible representation of supersymmetry. Whereas this thing here has the advantage that that the error correcting code exists, and therefore this thing splits. Yes, sir.
You also have doubly even up there. Are you?
Yes.
Is it just does it just turn out that all of the self-dual error correcting codes you're interested in are doubly even, or are you also demanding that?
No. For us, this is a discovery. It's not something we put into the calculation. Remember, we have these multiple ways of viewing the problem. So for us, what happens is we go back and sort of look at the old-fashioned way, which is thinking about what's happening in higher dimension with all the field components, where we know how to perform the split. And then we do the reduction to one dimension and then ask, what's going on in one dimension? So when we look at the nodes and we look at the matrices and we look at the addresses. And so it was a discovery for us that the things that this split here in upper and higher dimensions in terms of one dimension is reducing on self-dual error correcting codes.
Why don't singly even self-dual codes do it?
If you try to reduce this thing on a singly even self-dual code, what would happen is you would break space-time supersymmetry. So it's the most bizarre, one of the most bizarre things that I've ever seen. Demanding supersymmetry here says you have to pick special codes down there. And if you don't pick the special codes here, you break the supersymmetry up here. The fact that self-dual error correcting codes occur is both expected and unexpected. It turns out that whenever you're dealing with fermions, bits are actually always around. For a very simple reason. If you have a quantized theory with fermions, you have creation operators that act in a vacuum. But if you act in a vacuum, you can only do that once. That means if you keep track of the exponent on the various creation operators, those are in fact bits. They can only assume the values 1 and 0. So it's not surprising that you have bits in the theory. This happens whenever you have a theory with fermions. There have to be bits. The surprising thing for us is that demanding supersymmetry here picks out the self-dual error correcting codes to control the representation theory of the irreducible representations. That's the thing that's shocking for us. So let me finish by saying that my collaboration and I have been looking at this problem with 32 colors. Why 32 colors? Well, for those of you who know something about M-theory and 11-dimensional supergravity, you know that's a theory with 32 charges. And so, yes, if you're going to be concerned about such a theory, you might want to know something about the irreducible off-shell representations. Well, it turns out that this is a problem. If you didn't put a restriction on color, this is an NP-complete problem. That is, if you put no restriction on the number of colors, trying to figure out the number of irreducible representations is not something you can calculate in polynomial time. So, for us, since we're physicists, we're happy that 32 is there because, first of all, you can ignore the tail of the NP-complete problem, just try to calculate the part that you can calculate. But even there, it turns out that we've tried to do this with a supercomputer last year. And so this image that you see here is counting these number of self-dual codes. In other words, it's counting the number of irreducible representations. The table can be read as follows. In this direction, we count the number of times these things can be folded. It turns out that you can do one fold for four colors. But if you went to eight colors, you could actually do two folds. If you went to more colors, it turns out you could do more folds. Remember, with two colors or three colors, you could do no folds. So the number of folds that you can do things actually varies as a function of the number of colors. So what's going on in this table is, this way, I am counting the number of times I have folded an adinkra. I start with a given color, and I'm counting the number of folds. Along this axis, going back into the plane, is the number of supersymmetry, the number of supercharges. In fact, it's the N that you see here. So, as you can see, as you increase N, this line goes into the paper, so you can do more and more folding, which is kind of what you expect. However, what we've done here is calculate the number of different objects you get by folding in different orders, because it turns out the order of folding matters. So we started out a little computer code on a supercomputer doing this, and we let it run for about 2 months, and we found these results. Already found about 200,000 representations. We let it run for a few more months. We were up to about 10 to the 6, 8 times 10 to the 6 representations. Let it run for another couple of months. We were around 10 to the 11 representations. And at that time, we got thrown off the supercomputer cluster. Because it turns out that, you know, none of us are experts of how to write these sorts of codes. And though we had gotten time on the Ohio supercomputer cluster, and it was a vectorized program that would go whenever there was some downtime from other people's stuff, our stuff would run. But our stuff was very pernicious in the sense, in the fact that it wanted to eat up everything else. So we got thrown off. So all we can say is we have an estimate that for 32 colors, there are something like 10, we think about 10 to the 12, or 10 to the 14, between 10 to 12 and 10 to 14 different irreducible representations that you can get by this folding process.
Don't you have a log plot of that?
Say again?
Don't you have a log plot where in the vertical axis it's logarithmic? Kind of
product. Yeah, it looks like this. Thank you for asking. This is a lot of plot. So, that's what we've been up to. To me, the sort of the thing that I'm puzzled about, the thing that puzzles me most, is why self-through error correcting codes ever came into this game. You see, there was nothing in my initial construction that ever pointed me towards using these things, except for the fact that I wanted to be able to understand how the reduction of supersymmetry is manifest in this language of graphs and codes and Clifford algebras. As soon as we did that, that's the thing that forced us ultimately to understand the role of these self-through error correcting codes. But it's still a mystery, because you see, the equation of supersymmetry are like the conventional equations that we learn in physics. They're the Dirac equation, they're the Klein-Gordon equation, they're Einstein, the Cauchy equation that we classical physicists, well, field theorists and quantum field theorists have been dealing with for over a century. Why code should enter this construct is, to me, an incredible mystery. If we live in a matrix, you might expect this kind of thing to happen. That is, by deeply probing the equations that describe your universe, you might expect information theory structures to naturally arise. So, do we live in a matrix? Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Jim, you know, our tradition is with the psi scholars to get the first round of questions. Are you guys totally stumped? Yeah.
Sorry.
Left or right?
So the input for like the SRX is also like when you put the labels on it, the test diagram, I think, for like the Boolean algebra that is that just unrelated? Like,
it's not unrelated. See, what happens is the following. Supersymmetry, that is, supersymmetry has a kind of geometry. And the geometry is cubical. That's basically what we've discovered. And that's the origin of the fact that these things look like Boolean algebra. So anything, any kind of a theory where the orbit space is cubical will have manifestations like this. There was another hand.
Right. Yes. It seems pretty striking how you started out with just peppering cubes. Turning it into supersymmetry. But I don't think that, was this actually the way it was originally gone about?
Well, no. Of course not. What I have done is told you the most condensed version of how we got here. The actual way this started was with one of my graduate students, a young woman by the name of Lubna Rana, back in the middle 90s, was looking to start a thesis. And so I said, okay, well, let's study quantum and supersymmetric quantum mechanics as a warm-up problem for your thesis. And so we started playing with these systems, and very quickly we realized that there was a role for Clifford algebras that no one else had enunciated for supersymmetry. So the first thing we actually started was by understanding that there was a connection between Clifford algebras and supersymmetry that is not in the literature. And then later we start to understand more about this folding process. And it was only sort of fairly late in the process, maybe about 7 or 8 years after thinking about these things, that we realized that we were looking at the geometry of cubes. And in fact, it wasn't our realization, it was some of our mathematical colleagues that I had, this group that I formed, who actually looked at it and said, you know, you guys are actually looking at some kind of cubical geometry. And we visited, what are you talking about? Right? So no, the way I have told you the story is not the way it happened, but it is the bottom line.
Any other science students?
If you construct a superstring theory, then if you want to get off the mass shell, you have to do a superstring field theorem.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Since the 80s, we've known that such a superstring field is a phi cube theory. So the vacuum is not stable.
Okay, well, first of all, I would disagree with the statement that we know. Because I would claim we don't.
I delete them.
Oh, okay. I agree with you. I mean, you're exactly right. The thing that I am most interested in is to understand the possibilities of an off-shell covariant string field theory. That's exactly right. That's the final goal of all this. Now, we may not get there. We're trying to find the right tools for pointing us in that direction. Yes, that's what I think the answer is. We don't know how to do it, and I think part of the problem is just understanding the representation theory of supersymmetry is, in fact, we would claim, much more complicated than we collectively have understood up to this point. And so we're trying to probe that part of the problem. But yes, that's exactly what the net offshove is. And let me be even more specific. A number of people probably in this room have studied M-theory. And if you study M-theory, then you know that there's the BFS formalism, the Banks, Fisher, Susskind, Shanker formalism. And if you do BFSS, you also know that it basically seems to describe an 11-dimensional theory in the infinite momentum frame. This particular theory, if you are a supersymmetrist and have studied string theory, if you look at it, what it looks like is a Green-Schwarz string formula. So roughly, it's the analog of a Green-Schwarz string, but for M theory. For those of us who have studied string theory, and there are lots of people in this room who have, we know that in all of our previous experiences with strings, it has come at us in two different directions. It has come at us as a Green-Schwarz formalism, and it also has come at us in an RNS formalism. If you stop and think about that in the context of M theory, where is the RNS formalization of M theory? The answer is it's not known. And that's the other thing that we think is relevant for this set of considerations, is trying to figure out what that means.
I have two questions, one sort of pragmatic and the other fanciful. The pragmatic one is, you tried this thing for 32, and you got kicked off the computer.
Yeah.
Why not try, or has it been tried for a lower number, 16 or something, where you might have been able to obtain a concrete result, better learn how to correct your, make your coefficient?
Because you're exactly right. We were greedy.
You were greedy.
We were greedy. We were trying to get the, in fact, one of the things that we are now, we sort of
backed up and we're doing now is looking very carefully at the case of n equals 16. As you probably know, that's what you need for trying to discuss n equal four super Yang-Mills theory.
Yeah.
We'll be in that realm. So yes, we're doing that right now.
So that is of interest. You're doing it.
Absolutely. We were just we're trying to go for
not in. So okay. Yeah. So the fanciful one is, if I'd never heard of supersymmetry.
Yes.
Then I could perceive from this talk that if I started taking cubes and hypercubes and coloring them this way, I might have discovered it. So what structure might I discover if I go to some of the other Platonic solids, like an octahedron or a nico?
I have no idea what you discover doing that. Remember, this has been sort of experimental mathematics that I've been doing. We have no great theorems that are guiding us in this work. What we bring to bear is a different viewpoint and our experience with supersymmetry. I have a suspicion, though, and I'm willing to quote my suspicion. I don't think that anything other than a cube is going to lead to something interesting. Now, I don't know this for a fact, and it might be a very interesting topic for someone to figure out, to try to take the kinds of things that we've seen here and say that a platonic solid, that the edges of a platonic solid describe the orbits of some set of generators. I don't know what that would be, but I don't think it would work. I think there's something very special about cubes. It's just a guess.
A hunch.
Yeah, it's a hunch.
Okay, next question, comment? So ultimately, you want to break supersymmetry. I mean, if you wanted to describe our universe. Now, does that mean that you cannot use these structures, or maybe these are useful, like, high energy, but
right now my feeling is that these are only sort of high energy structures that that we're looking at. I don't have any special insight into the supersymmetry breaking in this context. In fact, as of right now, I barely know how to do interactions with it, although I haven't written anything on it. I and my collaboration have been looking at questions of what do interactions mean in this language. And there's some interesting mathematics there.
So you mentioned something about if you don't use, I think, a doubly even error correcting code, but if it's not doubly even, then it's not.
Ah, well, actually, that's a very interesting point. I had not thought about that, but your comment is actually very interesting, namely, is supersymmetry breaking somehow related to the use of non-doubly even self-dual codes? That's a great observation.
I don't know.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Okay, I will throw the last comment out. So where do the Archimedes fit?
Well, they do sort of fit in, it turns out. Let me see if I can get some numbers correct. If you look at these R and L objects I talked about, for the case of n equal to 8, what you find is the structure, I haven't looked at this in a lot of detail, but it reminds me a lot of the Octonian multiplication rule. You know, we know that there's relationships between spin 8 and octonions. And so those relationships are inherited here because these are Clifford algebras that we're talking about. There are other people that, I can give you some references, for example, Topin is a physicist who's actually done a lot of this sort of stuff. But as I told you in our private conversation, I try to avoid getting caught by octonions.
That's why I asked you.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, on that note, let's thank Jim very much for. Jim, just today, we had a very busy night, and we very much hope to be back.
Yeah, I definitely will come back, because there are people here who know a lot more about information theory than I do, and I want to learn some of it.